Accession number 11237, Reel 2.
Giles Reel 2. I saw them at night, and they didn't go away. They just lay down where they were and went to sleep on in the pavement. They were dressed in rags, and I remember their hair was never cut, so their hair was just like a bottle brush standing out. And they used to do extraordinary juggling acts and athletic acts and so on, and people would throw them a few cents for doing that. But, I mean, you know, it just seemed a fact of life at the time, but looking back on it, it was a simply horrific existence for them.
Can we go on to the war now, and can you tell me what you were doing when the announcement was made that we were at war with Germany?
Yes, I was steaming up the North Sea in HMS Emerald, and I remember being very surprised when the sun seemed to come up in the east as normal and nothing happened. It all seemed very normal. We then went into Scarpa Flow.
Did the announcement take you by surprise, or had you expected
not
it?
Really. No, not really by surprise.
What were the duties of Emerald at Scarpa in the early days?
We were part of what was called the Northern Patrol. And Emerald was an extraordinary old ship which had been the flagship in the East Indies before the war. She was very long and low and wet. She had, six-inch guns, all in open gun shields, not in turrets.
What was she, a cruiser?
She was a cruiser. She had 16 torpedoes, I was very proud of. She had three funnels, and when we were out in the Atlantic weather from the Northern Patrol, we were attached to the transatlantic convoys going across to Halifax, Nova Scotia. The seas would break all over the upper deck, and you couldn't really walk along the upper deck. And the depth charges, which were part of my responsibility, were secured on the quarter deck, and these used to break loose, and I could hear them in my cabin, which is one of the propellers, these depth charges as the ship rolled loose, each with I think 450 pounds of high explosive in them, rolling from one side of the deck to the other, bang, and then she'd roll the other way, and then bang, and then we'd have to get sailors with ropes around them and go and try and secure them and make them safe and so on. The torpedo tubes were mostly submerged in seawater, half submerged in seawater all the time, although they were upper deck tubes. Sometimes the waves were so strong that they would actually dent and damage the superstructure. The ship was by no means watertight. We had a navigator who was the most marvelous pianist, and occasionally we'd have sing songs in the wardroom. And then I think it was at Christmas, there was a very bad gale, and the piano broke loose and took charge, and it would, just as I've described the depth charge, it would go sliding across the wardroom, clang, and a sort of half chord would come out from it, and then it would go clang across the other bulkhead. And in the end, it was also secured, but it was all smashed up by this time. When we got into, I think, Liverpool, they tried to put it together again, and everything was missing, everything was there, except one note was missing. And nobody could understand how this one note was missing. And we said to the navigator, well, go on, don't bother about that note. But he said, no, I can't play it with the note missing. And nobody could, total mystery where this note had gone, until some weeks later, when the surgeon commander was mustering his sick bay stores, it was discovered that one of the splints had a white side to it.
How well prepared did you feel that the Royal Navy was for the war, for what was to come?
It was tremendously unprepared, really. Because, you see, again, one must remember how primitive things were. We had no radar, of course, not till years later. And so we always used to have to go to action stations at dawn in case the bigger area we could see contained an enemy. And I don't think we realized what was happening very much. Once our captain was a wonderful old chap called Garcia Agar, who was a VC from World War One. And once we intercepted a sort of large fishing trawler thing, and he stopped by it and hailed it and said, "Report your destination," through a megaphone. And they waved their hands, you know, they couldn't understand. And they were Norwegian, I think, and we're flying a Norwegian flag. And we said, "Report your destination." And then the skipper shouted, "Ah, herring fish." And so we let them go. But thinking about it afterwards, there were far too many men in that trawler. And they were probably Germans disguised as fishermen going out to as relief U-boat crews. But all that winter we were very lucky in the Emerald, and we saw no enemy, no U-boats, no anything. Of course, they weren't operating as intensively as they did later on in the war. But again, you say, how prepared were we? There was a little aircraft called a Fairey Sea Fox on a catapult in this ship up between the funnels. And every time we got into Halifax, this thing had been damaged, so it had to be by the wind, so it had to be towed away to the Canadian Naval Air Station at Dartmouth, Halifax, Nova Scotia. And it was made serviceable again, was towed out just before we sailed. And the first night at sea, it would always be written off again by the wind, because all its control surfaces would break and the fabric that its wings were made out of would tear, and it was useless. We were not very well prepared at all. And you know, those depth charges, which I was speaking about just now, were, in the small ships anyway, not set to safe. So, because they were expected to be used at short notice if they weren't in contact with the submarine. So, you were talking about the first night of the war. The first ship sunk in the war was the Exmouth, HMS Exmouth. And when she sank, all her depth charges exploded and killed all her ship's company, all the survivors going around in the sea. But of course, later on in the war, quite soon after that, we learnt to set the depth charges to safe until just immediately before they had to be released. Quite extraordinary. I don't think anybody's particularly to blame for this. I mean, it's very difficult to think out and visualize what the circumstances of war are going to be. When the Munich crisis was on, just before the war, when I was in HMS Vernon, this is a little flashback in time, I was sent to a destroyer called the Wolfhound in Chatham. And we were told that we had to get out of Chatham within 48 hours because the place would be laid flat by bombing within 48 hours of the outbreak of war. Well, of course, war didn't come then. But I remember two things about that. One was that the ship alongside us said, "Well, how are we going to get out of the dockyard in 48 hours because we hadn't got any boilers?" The ship was in the course of being, you know, refitted. From the reserve fleet, you see. These were old-fashioned World War One reserve fleet destroyers. And in the morning, there was one wretched ship's company still marching round the dockyard looking for their ship. And they halted beside us and said, "We can't find our bloody ship. Could you give us some breakfast?" So our people rallied round the way very well and gave them some breakfast. And it was discovered afterwards that this ship's company had been allocated to a ship which had been broken up some months before. Nobody had crossed her off the list. So, I mean, and this is again not criticism, it's just inevitable that these extraordinary things happen.
So, on the Emerald, were you engaged with the enemy at all in 39-40?
No. No, I wasn't.
You never saw the enemy at all?
No. But then, I was transferred to a newer ship, the Arethusa. That would have been in the spring of 19, just after Christmas, 1940. Yeah. And of course, the Arethusa, we were in the Norwegian campaign, taking troops across from Scarpa Flow to Arndal's Ness.
Were you bombed?
Oh yes, we were bombed, and we were not hit. We took the troops in there, and one morning I woke up having not had a night watch, and we were back in Scarpa Flow again. And I said, good God, what's happening? And they said, oh, well, we've got to land these troops we were halfway across with and go across empty and start bringing the stuff back again. And we got back to bring them back, the campaign having gone wrong. I've never forgotten the sight of the little, beautiful little wooden houses and villages on the banks of these fjords, with a group of huddled inhabitants on the end of the jetty waiting to be taken away, which we couldn't do, and the whole countryside, all the pine fir trees and so on, burning and black from the bombing which had happened on them. And that's the first time when we were taking men out from there that I ever saw men asleep on their feet. They were actually asleep, and they were queuing up to come on board us. And of course we only had a little narrow gangway like a ship can carry, and they had to come up one at a time. They were queuing up for this, and they'd queued up in a perfectly orderly fashion, and each soldier would have his head and his arms on the haversack or the knapsack of the chap in front of him, and they were actually asleep like that. And then when they shuffle forward a few paces, they just open their eyes and shuffle forward and be asleep again like that. Extraordinary sight. And one of them came on board with my old maths master from school, but that's nothing to do with the course of the war. We took back with us some French chasseurs alpins, and they were rough and tough people. And it's not a very nice story, but one of them had the head of a dead German in his knapsack.
Did you see it?
Yes.
Was the ship hit by the bombing?
Airfields was not hit, no. Not in that campaign, no. And then the Arethusa was... go on. Then the Arethusa was sent
to the Mediterranean?
Yes. We were in Sheerness, and we were bottled up there at the time of Dunkirk, because of the magnetic mines which were laid in the Thames estuary, and we weren't able to go out. But had the German fleet intervened at Dunkirk, we should have part of the striking force which would have had to risk the mines and go out and try and keep the German surface units away from the Dunkirk affair. But in fact we weren't not called on to move, but we were then sent down to the Mediterranean based on Gibraltar. And before we left, we went into Spithead, and and a dockyard lighter came out with a dozen magnetic mines, British magnetic mines, a type that I'd never seen before, brought out to me by an RNVR lieutenant called Hodges, who lives in Winchester to this day, and he showed me how to assemble these things, and we put them on deck and covered them over the tarpaulin, and off we went to Gibraltar. Then we were sent out with Force H to the Battle of Oran. And you remember the story there. We arrived at dawn, and in went HMS Foxhound with Admiral Holland on board with a huge white flag. He had just come from being the British naval attaché in Paris, or he was a former British naval attaché in Paris, and he spoke completely bilingual French, and he knew personally the French admiral who was in charge at Mosul Kabir. And he went in and said, well, look here, I'm sorry about this, old boy, but you see, we cannot risk having these fine ships of yours falling into enemy hands, and I'm instructed to give you an ultimatum that either you can come over and join with us, which would join in and continue the war, which would be, of course, the best, or you can go under escort to a neutral port and be interned, or you can scuttle your ships where they are, but we cannot do other than present you with this ultimatum, because we must prevent these marvelous great ships falling into the hands of the enemy. And amazingly, these Frenchmen dithered, and I think the first ultimatum expired at 11, and we were steaming up and down outside with a very considerable force, including HMS Ark Royal, two battleships, several cruisers, including the Arethusa. And the French dithered and asked for more time, and the negotiations went on. And of course, it was increasingly perilous situation, because every U-boat that the Germans had in the Mediterranean would have been making the best of its way to Oran, because they knew where the British fleet was and where we were. They had very good pickings, because we had nothing to do but steam up and down outside. And it was a dreadful business, because nobody ever thought we would actually have to open fire on the French. But you know the story. By 6 p.m., they still hadn't done anything. And so we opened fire on them. And I had transferred some of these magnetic mines to the Ark Royal, and her aircraft laid them in the channel. And I think one of their destroyers and one tug, I think, trying to escape, blew up on these mines. It was the first news that I ever knew of the British using magnetic mines. But of course, the French ships were absolutely massacred, because they, amazingly enough, they hadn't even cleared away their awnings so that they could train their guns on us, because they never believed we would do it. And in those days, the French, and some nations, including the French, had shells which had attached to them huge canisters of dye, vivid dye, so that when their big ships were firing, the splashes, instead of just being white, the shell splashes would be purple and orange, and they could see, therefore, if one gun wasn't firing properly and make adjustments. Otherwise, if one gun was obviously firing wrong, they wouldn't know which. We tried it, but we didn't like it as an idea. But I know that one salvo from their ships, when they did eventually open fire against us, fell and straddled the Arethusa, and I was on the bridge at the time in white uniform, and at the time this spray absolutely drenched us on the bridge, and when it subsided, we looked at one another, and all our uniform was absolutely bright purple like a typewriter ribbon. Very laughable at the time. But we were not hit, not damaged.
Did you see any of the hits on the French warships?
Well, of course, insofar as you could see it, we were, I don't know, quite considerable range, but you could see that the ships were blowing up and on fire, and there was smoke everywhere and that sort of thing. It was... it's always represented afterwards as being a most harrowing thing, and all tears in our eyes to open fire on our colleagues and so on, our allies and that sort of thing. But the fact of it is, it wasn't like that. It was a purely professional thing we were told to do, and it gives me the opportunity to remark that if a soldier meets an enemy face to face, he's expected to stick him in a belly with his bayonet and twist it round. In the Navy, it's a much more remote process, because you don't kill people at less than about 10,000 yards. You don't see the result except as a professional result if you're hitting or not. You don't imagine how many mother's sons are being burnt up or scalded with steam or whatever at the other end, any more than an airman does when he's dropping bombs over the Ruhr from 20,000 feet or whatever. How many people's girlfriends he's killing. So it, in a way, it's an easier task for us. It's a much more detached feeling, you see what I mean. So we weren't very harrowed about this. We were just wondering if we were hitting the target or not. There was a strange sequel to this Battle of Oran. I never talk, of course, to the French about having been present at the Battle of Oran, because with hindsight it was a terrible thing to have had to do, although I'm quite clear that we did have to do it for the reasons I've explained. But many years afterwards, I was commanding a destroyer in the Mediterranean, and we went to Mersel Kabir for a post-war visit, and it was the only foreign port I've ever been to in my life, in my entire service, where nobody took any notice of us whatever. Nobody was sent on board to see us, to welcome us, no liaison, nothing. We just lay there. So the British being, this was the strength of feeling all this time afterwards, I'm talking about 1951. So the British being British, put on dirty grey flannel trousers and went for a health-giving walk in the dog watches. And as we walked up over the hill out of the town, I saw a field with a very strange white crop in it. I thought, what the hell's that? And we walked up the hill towards it. As we got nearer, we saw that it was a cemetery with white concrete crosses in it. And it was vast. It was absolutely vast. And this was the cemetery from the people who'd been killed in the Battle of Oran. And as we got very close to it, and I could look over the fence, each little concrete cross, 2 or 3 feet high, had written on it, Dix Marins Inconnus, 10 unknown, unrecognized sailors. So that was the extent of the slaughter that was involved in that battle. So it's no wonder they feel strongly about it. And even now, if I go sailing, which I do, to Brittany, where of course a lot of their sailors come from, when they see a white ensign, who go there with a Royal Air Squadron ensign, some of them rush down and say how marvellous to see the white ensign again, and I served in the submarines with you and all this sort of business. And others will glare at it, spit in the sand and turn away, even now. Very, very deep scars. Makes us reflect how fortunate we are in Britain never to having been invaded for 1,000 years. Because the scars left by an occupation as France was occupied run very deep, obviously.
What other memories do you have of service aboard the Arethusa apart from Norway and Iran?
I came on leave at the time of the Battle of Britain, and when I got back there, in Sheerness Dockyard we were doing a short refit, the gunnery officer went on leave and I had to control the anti-aircraft guns in the night. Well, of course, enemy bombers would be droning across to attack to bomb London, and we fired our 4-inch guns up into the sky, and I said, how do you aim the bloody things? He said, oh, you don't, you just fire them into the sky. Partly to, you know, deflect and put off the bombers, and partly to cheer up the local population and break a few windows and make them think that a lot of things were happening, but it was as primitive as that. When I got back from my leave, there was a signal. They said, why have you come back? And I said, why not? And they said, well, there was a signal for you the other day. Didn't you see it? And I said, no, nobody had told me. And there was a signal saying I was report forthwith to room so-and-so in the Admiralty. And so I got in a bus, and I went up to Waterloo, I suppose. And I went into the Admiralty, into this room number, completely mystified by what it was. And I went into a room where there was a green lampshade shining down on the desk, and writing at the desk was my old captain, Captain Augustus Agar from VC, from the Emerald. And he looked up, he saw me, he said, sit down. And he was a very eccentric man, and his pen was racing over the paper that he was writing, and I remember it squeaking, and I thought, what in God's name is happening? Anyway, he signed with a flourish, licked it up, sent for a messenger, then he turned to me and said, come and have dinner. And we went around the corner to the United Service Club, and he explained to me that Churchill had just taken over as Prime Minister, and that he was determined to do something dramatic, and he said, I want to Drake singed the King of Spain's beard, I want to singe Hitler's moustache. And he said that Churchill has been taking advice from a thing called the Petroleum Warfare Committee, who had been doing experiments with a mixture of Admiralty oil and diesel and petrol in the Thames, with Thames barges and so on, and this mixture ignited and boiled the sea beneath it which then bubbled up and made it run around like quicksilver all over the place in an extraordinary way. And he said, I've been told to mount an operation to get four or five old Admiralty tankers, fill them up with this mixture, and we've got to go across and attack Calais and Boulogne, where the Germans are mustering huge numbers of Rhine barges for the invasion of Britain. And the invasion fever was its height at the time. He said, you're to leave the Arethusa. I've got permission to have you as my staff officer for this thing. And you're to go round the dockyard where I've got these four tankers, I think there were five eventually, install the charges for scuttling them and for igniting this stuff, because the torpedo branch which I belong to were the demolitions and explosives experts, so-called. And he said, what's more, you ought to be my staff officer for the whole operation. I just don't want you to only do the explosives. And we have top priority for anything we want. We had cars, communication, signals, everything. We were based on the Admiralty, but we'd tear around to these, I think some were in Chatham and some were in Portsmouth, these ships. They eventually all gathered in Chatham. And they were extraordinary old, worn-out reserve Admiralty tankers. They had volunteer crews in them because in those days there was an Admiralty fleet of water going around that people who were prepared to volunteer for special or unusual service might be sent for. And they all had volunteer crews, very small crews, about a dozen in each. And the idea was that we should fill them up with this mixture, sail them across, and take off all but about three volunteers who just steer the ship in and crash through the barge, crash through the boom, which of course these French ports had booms across them, and crash through the boom, and then the three volunteers remaining on board would have a little speedboat thing lured to the water level on Davits, and they'd scramble down into this thing and have some chance of escaping. Not that they would have any chance of escaping, but anyway. And the idea was that the ship would sail through the boom, and a couple of minutes later, the scuttling charges would operate, and she'd settle down, and then the ignition charges would operate, and then this extraordinary mixture would run round. It was always to be on a flood tide, run round inside the harbour, burning up the barges and the troops in them and that sort of thing. And the trials showed that the flames leapt, that the warfare committee had done, the Petroleum Warfare Committee had done, the flames would leap 100 feet into the sky, and a human being would last 2 seconds in them and that sort of thing. It was supposed to be very effective stuff. Well, this was done under conditions of enormous priority. Highly exciting, dramatic time, I found it. And under conditions of very great secrecy, and it was called Operation Lucid. Nobody knew anything about it.
What about the problem of getting people to man them as they went in?
Well, as I say, they only had, I think, the commanding officer and a helmsman, and one other. I think were all left on board as they set them at the boom. You see, set them full speed at the boom. And then 100 yards outside the boom, they hoped to hop into the speedboat and escape, but they wouldn't have been able to. But then the ship would just take itself on through the boom, and they'd be on board.
But we were talking earlier about the motivation of people in...
Oh, yes.
Getting people to do these dangerous things.
Well, we were, and good for them, but these were chaps who volunteered for this sort of thing, and they were dead keen about it. Dead keen about it.
Was that out of patriotic feelings?
What?
Was that because of patriotic feeling?
It was a time when there was...